and welcome to another episode of Police in America. I'm your host, Darren Wilburn, and we, for those of you who have not heard a previous show, we cover issues from street-level police brutality all the way through the constitutionality of the existence of police. You'll recognize some of that from our previous shows and guests. We've discussed so far several forms or several opinions concerning the constitutionality of police. And we've also seen how police tend to lose their professionalism and objectivity in the field. Now, tonight we have a guest whose story you're simply just not going to believe. I've been doing research on this individual, and this is not only police misconduct, and I'm not talking about your local or county law enforcement. I mean at the federal level. I know, shocking. Federal law enforcement misconduct, but it's compounded by the judicial support of this misconduct and the fact that the judiciary procedures that this individual was involved in violated so many of the constitutionally protected and inalienable rights of this individual that I'm completely at a loss for words to describe it. So I'm going to let the guest describe it. Tonight's guest is Dave Olufsen. Now, Mr. Olufsen, a veteran, honorable man, a father, husband, and patriot. Loved his country, still does. Believed in the American way of life. And because of a simple, uninformed mistake, not even a mistake. Yeah, I mean, to make a mistake, you have to, you know, make some kind of action. That's just not this. This is amazing to me. This story is just something you wouldn't believe if someone told you they heard about it. So you're going to get it straight from the victim, and I do refer to Mr. Olufsen as a victim because that's what he is. He was forced to spend 30 months in a federal penitentiary, even though the state or the prosecution had no real evidence against him. As a matter of fact, they had exculpatory evidence, the things that cleared his name, and it didn't matter. It didn't stop their zeal in continuing to investigate and prosecute this case. As a result, Mr. Olufsen, his life has been destroyed completely. He now carries the stigma of a felon. So employment is very difficult, if not impossible. His family has been ripped apart. He continues to suffer at the hands of the courts in regard to his family. And actually, this story disturbs me on a level that I thought, you know, I was beyond. I've been a private investigator for 20 years. I do criminal defense work, and I've seen all kinds of misconduct by police. I get a chance to review their reports, and I get a chance to see the evidence firsthand often. And this leads me, well, it's actually what caused me to even want to do this show, make people understand that the media and TV programs and movies where cops are constantly the good guys, always the good guys, ones that whose death is above all other citizens. If a citizen is killed in the street, oh, that's bad. But if a cop is killed in the streets, oh, my God, there's a national outcry. There's a wall in Washington, D.C. for officers killed in the line of duty. Well, they even compile the numbers of citizens that are killed by police unarmed, much less give them a wall. So I want to introduce Mr. Olufsen, and he will bring you a story and information that I encourage you to research on your own. Please look up and research all of the information that he's going to give you in this story. And I think that you will find, as I did, that this is, you wouldn't believe it could happen in the United States of America. So, again, our guest is Dave Olufsen. Mr. Olufsen, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Darren.
thank you for joining me tonight. I really appreciate you sharing your story. And to get started, what I'd like to do is just have you give the listeners, a little bit of background, where you come from, when you were growing up, what you wanted to do, and how you joined the military, all the way up to this incident occurring, and then take a break, and we'll start asking some simple questions to get the listeners, give them an idea of who you are.
Well, in a nutshell, I grew up in rural Wisconsin, out in the country, and I did that all the way up through my last 3 years of high school, where we actually moved on the outskirts of a mid-sized town in Wisconsin. You learn to, hunt, fish, and handle firearms out in the country normally, and there's no issues with that. Straight out of high school, I went into the Army. I did 4 years of active duty as a infantryman with a couple additional duty slots and training schools on top of that. Got bounced around a lot back in the early 90s there from one post to another. Got out within a few months, jumped back into reserves while going through college. Initially in correctional science, while I had to wait a year, got into the police academy and did an additional 2 years up there, and bounced in and out of the reserves twice, putting in a total of 17 years before it was ended on July 2nd when I had to report to Sandstone.
Sandstone.
That was the federal prison up in Minnesota where I did the 21 months out of the 30-month sentence.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did state that you did 30 months. So fair to say that this, in my opinion, wrongful conviction ended your military career.
Correct. The military didn't shuffle the paperwork until after I was up in prison. They were actually quite polite about it. They understood what was going on. On the local level, they didn't really agree with it, so they kept me in as long as they could. But eventually, the rules are very clear. If you have any kind of felony conviction that interferes with service, you do have to be removed, if you can't serve. So that was my fourth discharge from the military. That one, my first three were honorable. That one, I ended up taking a general under honorable conditions. That's upgradable to honorable later on.
Okay. And now, prior to that, had you been convicted of any violent felonies, any violent misdemeanors or firearms charges? Had you ever been convicted of anything of the like?
There's been no violence. Even the federal charge here, we're talking about $200 in taxes. So there's no violence whatsoever. Right to carry advocate in Wisconsin where up until relatively recently, you could not carry a concealed firearm. That just started last year. Prior to that, the only legal way to carry was in the open. So I was one of the few people here going back long before it was popular that would actually carry in the open. That led to...
I'm sorry, sir. And would you say that you were an outspoken proponent for firearms and critical of laws that restricted firearms, either their possession or their carry, individual citizens' ability to carry? Would you say that you were outspoken in that?
I would say I was extremely outspoken, and unlike, the police tend to listen to and relatively ignore people that will grumble about it, but when you actually start exercising your rights in public the way I did, they find that pretty much intolerable, and around here anyways, they seem to take it as a challenge to their authority, even though, everything I was doing was perfectly legal. So okay, I was arrested multiple times for legally carrying a firearm. And invariably, they'd either try and throw a blanket charge on it, saying that it was disorderly conduct because somebody called in and didn't like me carrying a firearm in public, mm-hmm. or they would try to manufacture charges of carrying a concealed weapon. It got to the point where, in order for me to carry, I had to make sure that other people were with me and video cameras were present. The last time, you know, it was very effective, and we actually caught the officer, you know, perjuring himself openly in court after, you know, stating that I was running around with a gun under my jacket. There was an exchange of information voluntarily with one of the deputies that was supposed to destroy the 911 tape that was called in. Part of the reason that they didn't want that tape to exist was that the 911 operator clearly asked the person on the line if the individual that they thought had a firearm was acting in a disturbing manner, threatening anybody. Did they see the weapon under, flashed from under a coat or something like that? And the person clearly stated that, no, they seem to be acting normal. You know, the gun's in a holster and it's right out in the open. When you add that to the video that, you know, we had showing the firearm in the open, me telling the officer, what's the problem? You know, the gun's out in the open, and the officer responding that, well, it's in a holster, that's concealed enough for me. That kind of, you know, sealed that particular case in my favor. But it's the kind of thing that, you know, people in Wisconsin had to tolerate a lot of. The general rule was you may have the right to carry a weapon in the open, but only an idiot would actually try to exercise the right because they all knew what would happen. Even the past few years.
Now I want to ask you this. Because you had the audacity to actually exercise your First and Second Amendment protected rights, and this all occurred prior to the federal conviction, yes?
Correct.
Okay. Do you think that, and I know this is kind of a almost stupid question, but do you believe that, or do you have any evidence that it affected the federal courts in their decision to continue prosecuting you under any and all circumstances?
I wouldn't say that there's any evidence that they decided to prosecute me because of that, other than, you know, the proverbial whispers in the hallway. Mm-hmm. I do know that the mere fact, like during sentencing, the mere fact that I chose to exercise my right to carry firearms in the open was held against me by the judge, where he pointed out that it went to show that I had a propensity to commit crimes and lack of appreciation for authority just because I would, you know, dare to merely carry a firearm.
To me, that really says that your rights and rights people, again, I want to bring this up, rights ascend far above the level of laws. Rights ascend far above everything that has ever been written down in human history. Rights are rights. They are not they're not decided by nor granted by government. Rights exist because you exist. But because you had the audacity to exercise a right, despite the fact that the authority disapproved of it, then you say that you have evidence that that actually, well, I guess so. If a judge said it in open court, that's pretty much evidence that they went after you, for lack of a better term. They went after you more zealously than they would have someone else because you had, again, the audacity to believe in and exercise rights. Now, are you still with me, Mr. Olson?
Oh, yes.
Okay. All right. let's get right to the meat of the matter. And can you give me a factual timeline of this circumstances that led to your arrest, your initial arrest, and then we'll get into the judicial process and continued investigative process that I find so amazing. But just give us a timeline of the events that resulted in your arrest for the charge that you were ultimately convicted of.
Okay. I don't have a calendar here with me, but just going off of what I remember, the initial problem occurred, it would have been early in 2007, where one of my neighbors, having at least told me that he had just graduated high school, being 18, was interested in military service. Of course, back then, the bonuses that they would pay out was substantial, upwards of, you know, $3,000 or so if we could get someone to sign up. So there was good incentive for me to want to give him a little basic training and see if I could get him signed up in the military, as I have some people in the past. And the easiest way to hook someone, you know, for military service is to give them a little training and let them shoot something similar to what they would see in service. So our neighbor there, Mr. Kernicke, borrowed this gun repeatedly, and you know, I'd give him a little ammunition. He'd buy some locally bought ammunition. And this went on for, you know, give or take, about 3 months. The firearm in question was one that I've had for an exceedingly long time. It's, you know, been worn down and had to have parts replaced more than once because of the amount of ammunition run through it. And it was generally just a beater that I would loan out to people after, you know, giving them instructions on how to use it and making them break it apart and making sure that, you know, generally they could do what was necessary with the firearm and that they would conduct themselves safely when out at one of the local ranges.
Can you tell the listeners what type of firearm that was, the design, and if you don't mind, the manufacturer?
It was an old Olympic Arms Car AR model, which was like a small commando style or XM-177 style AR-15 type weapon that was designed to, you know, look similar to what the military XM-177 did during the Vietnam War.
Okay, thank you. So this neighbor, and you mentioned his name, Mr. Kornicke?
Kernicke, yes.
Okay, and now is he in any way related to Mark Kornicke?
Not that I know of.
Okay, all right. That was for my, because I wasn't aware of his last name, so carry on. He was borrowing your weapon and buying his own ammunition.
Yes, he'd borrow the weapon, and he finally came by, and he's like, well, I don't have any more money. I'd like to, you know, go out shooting. I got two other friends that want to come with me and shoot. Could I borrow some ammunition and pay you later? I said that wouldn't be a problem, so I gave him a half case of regular, you know, military ammunition that I kept around just for that particular type of weapon. A couple days later, while he was still at the range, you know, he called me and he was all panicked about, you know, police showing up, and I was like, well, you don't have to worry about the police showing up, you know, as long as you yourself aren't doing something wrong, what's the issue? And at that time he explained, well, the only problem was he didn't pay the $5 range fee. So I told him, well, go down, pay your fee, stop trying to sneak in at the range, and you know, don't worry about it, you know, there's no problems. Then you know, I got some calls from the officers asking me about the, you know, where my machine gun permit and everything was, and I'm like, permit for what machine gun? You know, and they're like, well, there's some questions about the firearm at the range. I'm like, no, there isn't. There's nothing wrong with the firearm that I loaned out. And we went back and forth a little bit, but basically, the ATF told them. Yes, there was some phone calls back and forth.
Okay.
Both between Kernicke and myself, and then the Berlin Police Department and myself. The Berlin Police Department didn't know what to make of it, really. They called the ATF. The ATF told them well, just go run and seize the gun and we'll take care of it. So Berlin PD went to Mr. Kernicke's house, seized the firearm in question, held on to it until the ATF got a hold of it. Then 2 weeks later, they executed a search warrant on my house looking for, I mean, if you listen to their warrant, they tried to describe it like I was some kind of arms dealer selling firearms under the table without an FFL. They tried to say I forged an FFL license and was using that to obtain firearms and sell them. There's just a whole litany of stuff that, you know, anyone that was familiar with me would laugh at.
All right, now let me stop you here and ask you two things. One, how many, in your estimation, how many times had you loaned this particular firearm to this particular individual?
If I remember correct, it was 3 times.
Okay, so on his third trip to the range, he became concerned. And in your telephone conversations with him, what did he say to you, aside from the fact that he was concerned that you know, he hadn't paid the range fee, he'd sneaked in, what was his concern, or why did the police even become involved in what and take interest in your firearm? What had happened to the firearm or to him at the range?
Initially, the only thing he told me was that he hadn't paid the range fee and that the police showed up, and he told me, well, they regularly show up to check and see if people are actual members at the conservation club. All I could do was chastise him for, I mean, it costs like $5 a year. So why wouldn't you pay your range fee and become members for a year, even if you only go out there and shoot once a year? The range fee was inconsequential. That was the only thing told to me. Later on, I found out that basically, if I'm to believe what I was told, again, it's hearsay because there's no witnesses to state this, just police officers saying so, they mm-hmm. say that they received a call that there was an automatic weapon at the range.
An automatic weapon,
but,
not a simple.
Yeah, an automatic weapon, which is why they went out there. And I've had them come out before, too, but usually that's, you know, if you're out there and you're shooting rather rapidly. And at that range, you know, any kind of true automatic weapon is not allowed because it's not a regular shooting club. It's a conservation club. If you shoot rapidly, they only allow that when other festivities, especially their skeet and trap, aren't going on. Because they consider it disturbing, so you must shoot rather slow. So, you know, my guess is if he was out there pulling the trigger or trying to bump fire the weapon, that might have caused someone to call in. You know, I myself, out there with friends, have had the police called on us just because we had, you know, ugly military-looking weapons on the range. You'd be surprised.
Okay, so the weapon fired more rapidly than what fellow range tenders were comfortable with? Is that the case?
That was my initial estimation of what happened. Again, I wasn't there. I can't say what went on.
Okay.
According to the police officer, you know, he says that it was firing more than one round at the range, but, you know, all I have is his word for it.
You mean more than one round per pull of the trigger? In other words, it was behaving in a manner, or according to the police, it was behaving in a manner where you pull the trigger and more than one round would discharge.
That has been relatively unclear. According to the officer, it shot rapidly. But, you know, in his report, he also stated, you know, he doesn't have the training to understand what it was doing, if it was firing more than one round, or if you know, the trigger was just sensitive.
Okay.
It was, you know, without me being there, I can't say what happened. And the police reports dealing with that really weren't, you know, brought up in trial whatsoever. They just kind of got buried in the pile as, you know, not really being relevant to what happened or what they were trying to accuse me of.
All right. And what was it eventually they accused you of?
Well, we waited 2 weeks. We had the search warrant issued on the house, whereupon you know, I was, you know, cuffed, thrown in the car, and then dragged downtown for questioning. And although I was told I was not under arrest, I was also told I was not free to leave, and I had to answer questions. After that, we waited several months. It took about 30 days for me to get our computers back, and a couple of, it was like 3 or 4 months after that, before they actually came down with an arrest warrant. Later on in the court paperwork, we found out that it took them that long doing multiple tests and changing their testing procedures before they could get the firearm to fire more than one round. And even then, relatively unreliably to start with, until they, you know, made some other changes that they didn't talk about. And a lot of that...
To the firearm?
To the firearm, apparently. We weren't allowed to inspect anything, to run our own testing, nothing like that. And our expert witness, Len Savage, the closest they would let him get to it to inspect it was about 5 feet, and that was right at the start of the trial. And he noted that all the firearm trigger components in the weapon were all brand new and still had the, you know, crystalline formations on them of a brand new trigger group. So there's still questions about exactly how far did the change in testing procedures with the ATF go. You know, they already admitted that they couldn't get it to fire more than once by using the proper ammunition. They had to switch over to some very, very sensitive ammunition that's supposed to be used only in bolt-action rifles, stuff that you would never use in a military-style semi-automatic weapon that does not have a retention spring on the firing pin. But, you know, it's always been a question, what exactly, you know, happened to the trigger group? I know during trial, and this has led to questions in the case and some confusion by the general public, basically during trial we never made an issue about the trigger group because so far as we could tell, the trigger group of the weapon was similar or the same as what it came from the factory. And from the factory, these weapons from the factory did have some M16 components in them. Not all of the components, just some. And likewise, this weapon, from what Mr. Savage could see in the courtroom, also did not have all the M16 components. It had some. You know, most notably, it did not have an automatic sear, did not have any machining for the sear, and it had a AR-15 bolt carrier that was supposed to stop any particular malfunction. The bolt carrier, as noted by him, was severely beat up and looked like it also had somehow been modified or ground down and changed. And it was,
all right, now, I understand that they not only changed their testing procedures and probably went beyond the parameters of whatever written protocol they had for those procedures, but also they replaced parts in this firearm and continued to do so until they could get it to discharge more than one round per pull of the trigger. Is that correct?
That part of that is our assumption. I say that because the firearm itself, back in 1994, I myself replaced the trigger group with a DPMS AR-15 trigger grouping. And
mm-hmm.
that was not the trigger group that was in that weapon when Mr. Savage was allowed to peek at it from 5 feet. In addition to that, the fact that the trigger grouping appeared to be brand new goes to show that it was not what was in there, you know, when that firearm was originally loaned out.
Okay. All right. So now you've walked us up through, you were held, handcuffed, transported, and held until you couldn't leave, but you weren't under arrest at that time until later, once they were able to get the firearm to finally malfunction, you were then arrested, and take us from that point.
Yes, there was, you know, the lot thrown in handcuffs, dragged away, told, you know, you're not under arrest, but you're not free to leave, you must answer questions. We had to wait several months Some of the paperwork that came forth during trial was paperwork from the ATF. I believe it was Mr. Tingry, the firearms testing agent at that time, who did repeated tests on the weapon, and all of his initial paperwork repeatedly said the weapon was not a machine gun, in part because he could not get it to malfunction in the manner that, you know, it was said the weapon was malfunctioning.
Okay.
When the field agent, Special Agent Jody Kiku, heard about that, you know, she wrote, and we have that paperwork from court also, wrote back and told him, you know, we were told that this is what it was doing, you know, find a way to make it happen that way. And that's when basically he went away from, you know, regular protocols and did God knows what to that weapon to make it function in the way that they wanted it to.
Now,
but
you referred
to like 3 or 4 months.
Okay, you referred to Special Agent. Now, is that FBI or was this a BATFE agent?
These are all BATFE.
Oh, okay. Oh, so the ATF was the lead on all investigations and testing in throughout this case. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. So eventually you were arrested and charged. Tell us about what you were charged with and just as importantly, what you were not charged with. I don't believe you were charged with possessing an illegal machine gun, were you?
No. Despite all their bluster up front and the numerous and very lengthy accusations they made about, you know, me being part of this underground manufacturing and, you know, firearm distribution set up merely, you know, because I've sold, I think over the past 20 years prior to that, I probably sold 4 or 5 guns. So apparently that made me some kind of gun runner in their eyes. But after, you know, telling the judge that I was part of all of this and that they were positive that I was part of much more and you know, more detailed, broader, and more heinous crimes, what it came down to was they charged me with, I believe it was Section O, 18 U.S.C., 922 Section O, if memory serves, don't quote me on that, which was transferring a machine gun without paying the tax. There was no trying to charge me with possession. The reason they charged me with that was, in their new opinion, all they needed to do was prove that the firearm fired more than one round, and that there, of course, you had the knowing component. Well, the knowing component came from Mr. Kernicke, who, after being threatened with 10 years in prison, pretty much would repeat anything that they told him to. And then, of course, the machine gun portion came from, you know, can we get it to fire more than one round? Well, of course, if you throw the wrong ammunition in the gun and you mess with it enough, you can make, you know, pretty much any weapon fire more than one round. You know, it got so bad that, like the expert witness in my case, Len Savage, in order to try and get even with him for testimony in my case, they put Kingery, the firearms branch technician who tested my weapon, they put him in a position over Mr. Savage, and he promptly started reversing and prior decisions on some of his work and refusing other things, including, like, I think the biggest thing that happened with him immediately afterwards, he had some conversion kits that would fit on top of a semi-automatic firearm that would turn it into a belt fed, so you didn't have to use a magazine. Now, they're similar kits sold by many manufacturers, and the ATF has repeatedly ruled that they are nothing more than parts kits. And in his case, they took the parts kit along with some duct tape, zip ties, and a little bit of chain, made a few parts themselves, taped everything and zip-tied it together and made a video of it being able to fire like two rounds before the thing blew up, and then said, see, it fired more than one round. It's a machine gun. And their harassment of him has caused him no end of headaches also, but like me, it really hasn't deterred him from, you know, speaking out against the injustices that he's seen the BATFE commit.
Now, after you were arrested, were you offered, were you afforded bail, and were you able to stay out of jail while they prepared for trial?
Yes, we exited with nothing. After some arguments, we exited with nothing more than a signature bond, you know, saying that I promised to show up and keep arguing. And it was that way all the way through the end, even after the conviction. You know, normally they handcuff you and drag you off right away. In my case, they didn't even bother. You know, they just said, go home, we'll mail you something. You know, and a couple weeks later, you get notice from the U.S. Marshals where and when they expect you to report.
All right. Okay. Now, take me up to... And I want to get, I know that you have a very important co-guest, for lack of a better term, who's waiting, and I'll be very, very proud to announce this individual. But before we get to that, take me through trial procedures. Well, before we get to that, was there a time that during the investigation or prior to your trial, where your family was placed in danger, of course, unbeknownst to them and you, concerning maybe some items that were left in their home?
Well, there was numerous problems we had. The ATF showed up at my home and harassed my wife and family on a couple different occasions. And then there was one occasion where I got a phone call from my parents asking me if I had been at their house and left anything for them.
Now, how far did you live?
Point, from my parents at that time would have been about an hour drive, give or take, hour and 15 minutes.
Okay. And would you on a routine basis show up without them knowing you were coming?
No. I mean, they're my parents. I love them, but with the family and everything being up in Berlin, it was just too far to, you know, constantly and repeatedly show up down at their place. So it really didn't happen very frequently at all. Not as often I would like.
Not a problem. What I was trying to establish there is that, you know, it would be, they were probably concerned because they thought someone had been at their house, and so they called you to say, hey, have you been here?
Yeah, so especially given what they found.
Right, yeah. Take us from there and explain not only what they found, but also the coincidences that you later discovered concerning what they found.
Yeah, from my father's phone call, I couldn't tell what was left. All he said was, you know, it looked like a Ziploc baggie full of gun parts, you know, which mm-hmm. confused me. I mean, why would you find a Ziploc baggie full of gun parts on the floor of your house, right out in the open? And it didn't make sense. I hadn't been there. It left a question in our head that went unanswered until the trial. During discovery in the trial, one of the reports that was written by Special Agent Jody Kiku, which was written on the same day that my father called me, was that...
Okay, now, let me stop you, sir. I know you've had to go through this story a million times, and so I just don't want want you to assume that the listening audience understands what happened. So your father came home. He'd been gone for the day, and he came home and found a Ziploc baggie in his home. And tell us where it was found and what was in it.
It was found in the dining room area of his house. After, you know, seeing the parts myself and then having someone dispose of them a little later, it was a series of M16 components, including everything necessary outside of the bolt carrier itself. if you happen to have an M16 that was registered, this would have been what you used to essentially rebuild the innards of the firearm.
You referenced an M16 because we have many listeners who are new or unfamiliar with firearms. He's talking about a fully automatic weapon. This is a weapon that was designed to discharge sequentially more than one round per pull of the trigger. And your father found this in his home after returning home and called you to ask if you had been there. And what, I mean, you know, obviously he was curious. I don't even know if he was concerned at that time. He was curious about where this baggie had come from.
Correct. And, of course, the only person he knows that would have any firearms stuff at all would have been me. So he called me, and I had to tell him, no, I haven't been. It's been like 2.5 weeks before I was at your house, and I haven't been there today, so I don't know what it is. He held on to it until I could inspect it, which was another couple of days. When I did inspect it, it was very clear to me. I spent nearly 3 years on active duty with an additional duty assignment as an armorer. So, you know, I knew what the parts were right off the bat, why they were there, how they got there. We had no clue. But one of the oddities that popped up during a discovery in the trial was that on that same day, Special Agent Jody Kiku had a report written where she said her, another BATFE agent and a Fond du Lac County Sheriff's deputy came out to my parents' house to talk to them. But nobody was home, so they left. It was, you know, nobody, we have no proof to say that they dropped it here. But the fact that the report says they were here on the same day that this was found in my parents' house, it's still a big question mark in our minds. You know, it was never brought up by any law enforcement agents. They never attempted to question my parents after that. Why they were here, you know, we don't know.
All right, now, but, listeners, I want you to understand something. One thing, one law I have absolutely learned in my years as a private investigator is that coincidences are almost, they're so rare that they're almost non-existent. True coincidences almost do not exist. There's always a cause and effect for things to happen in conjunction with each other. Now, also, what most people may not know is, well, they may say, well, why would she put in a report that she was there the same day that this bag was found? Well, law enforcement officers, all the way up through the federal level, must account for their time. They have to report to their command where they are and what they're doing, what they've done. You know, if they're gone for a couple of hours, they must create a report for why and where they were. So if, now we don't know, again, he's already stated, and you'll agree with me, Mr. Ellison, we have no evidence to indicate that they may have dropped this bag there. But if that was her objective and she accomplished it, she still must account to her chain of command for where she was for that time. And certainly, you know, the best lie that you tell is the one that is as close to the truth as possible. She couldn't say she was somewhere else when she could run the risk of someone seeing her and the uniformed deputy who was present at his parents' home on the very same day that she says, oh, no, I was in such and such county taking care of something else. You know, there may be a witness that says, oh, we saw the cops there at your house. So that would explain why the report would have to be submitted, that she went by simply to talk to him, but no one was, or talk to them, and no one was home, so they left. So anyway, that, now again, that's not my opinion on things, but it also is how I have seen these kinds of operations happen in the past. So anyway, carry on, Mr. Olson.
What point were we?
Okay.
There.
So she had submitted paperwork stating that she'd gone to your parents' home to speak to them. No one was home, and yet that was the same day that your father found this mysterious bag with fully automatic M16 parts inside it.
Yes, the parts themselves were disposed of, and That was, no one ever brought it up. That was the last we ever heard of that outside of that report by Special Agent Kiku. But it was, that particular thing was never talked about again after that. The rest of the time was mostly going back and forth with government attorneys, and that, to say it was a zoo is a gross understatement. From, you know, initially everything kind of looked okay to me. You know, I had two attorneys assigned to me. We already went through one private attorney who ended up getting booted off the case for incompetence. The two government attorneys that we had assigned after that, at least initially, seemed okay. They even introduced me to a private investigator who, you know, was supposed to go out and follow and interview all my witnesses. Later on, you know, as time went on, the more and more I talked to them, asking questions, looking for answers, the less they spoke to me and clammed up completely.
Did the private investigator actually,
the private investigator, I saw him once and then he disappeared. Never saw him again after that.
Okay.
So you know, all of my witnesses that I wanted interviews, they never happened. When it started getting close to trial time, I'd push my attorneys to get certain things done, and you know, they made it very clear it just wasn't going to happen. You know,
I'm sorry, sir. Was this a court-appointed investigator, or were you paying him privately?
These were all court-appointed.
Okay.
I can't imagine paying people to, you know, do as little as what happened here. I mean, other than, you know, showing up in court and having some paperwork, they did put in a couple of boilerplate motions, but there was very little attempt at any kind of defense.
All right. Let's take the next, say, 12 minutes or so and kind of walk us through, give me your experience, your first-hand experience. Did you receive a fair trial?
What trial? I showed up and there was a circus that went on, a dog and pony show, but that wouldn't resemble any kind of trial that any law student would recognize. Like I was saying, there was no interview of any of my witnesses. I had plenty of witnesses lined up that could, you know, speak to both my character, my habits as far as how I'll give people some basic training and the safety briefs I give them and how I make sure that they know how to operate any of the weapons that I would loan out. I had one key witness in particular that, you know, nobody would put on the stand, judge or my attorneys, who had this weapon immediately before my neighbor got it. Him and his family had shot that weapon for give or take about 3 months and, you know, put give or take 1,000 rounds to it. And I even brought him to the courtroom and they would not put him on the stand. He could have told them up front, hey, I had this weapon in this time frame, which was, you know, only a few days before Mr. Kernicke got it. And this weapon never once malfunctioned. This weapon, the selector switch did not go to a third position. There was never any problems with it. Things like that, you know, when it comes to the knowing portion, you know, with the government saying, well, he knew because Mr. Kernicke said that he told them it would fire more than one time if he did this. You know, it goes to show that, well, I never said that before. Why would I say it to somebody that I've only known for a few months? You know, that no one in their right mind would loan out a malfunctioning gun, and you would have to be insane to publicly start loaning out unregistered machine guns. You know, it was a ludicrous situation. But, yeah, I even brought, you know, at least one witness, the one that I considered most key to the case, and I had a few others on tap that could have been there, you know, within 45 minutes or so. And, you know, my attorneys refused to put him on the stand. We brought it to the judge. We told the judge what he could testify to. We were basically told that, well, that's not germane to the case. We're not talking about the gun when he had it. We're talking about the gun when Mr. Kernicke had it. You know, what he has to say has nothing to do with it. You know, they didn't want me on the stand prior to the trial. I had repeatedly and vehemently yelled at my attorneys and to the judges in the case, since I went through multiple judges, that I wanted the evidence examined independently. You know, I knew about the ATF's past. I trust them obviously even less today than what I used to. And I was like, I need independent people to look at this and tell me what's going on. And I was repeatedly turned down, you know, and told that basically the same thing we were told in the courtroom with Mr. Savage, which was, you know, only government agents and government-trained people are knowledgeable enough and have the appropriate training to testify about what a weapon is and is not in the courtroom. Only government people with government training. That was their reason and how they tried to disqualify Mr. Savage by stating that, you know, he only manufactures and designs firearms. Therefore, he's not qualified to testify about the legality of a firearm because he only designs and manufactures them. You know, government agents, we read a book and therefore, you know, and someone will talk to us for a little bit, therefore we know exactly what we're doing. But the guy that actually makes the guns and builds them from scratch, he doesn't know anything.
Roger that. Now, were you allowed to present any substantial witnesses for your defense? Anyone
No.
that was able to? None.
No one.
So this was simply a prosecution with no real exculpatory testimony by witnesses that could say, hey, listen, this is the truth of the matter. You know, whether it was based on opinion, experience, or not, you were just not allowed to present defense witnesses.
Correct. My attorneys wouldn't let me take the stand. They would neither interview nor, when I brought, you know, a key witness, they would not put him on the stand. And the judge, you know, when I argued with him, the judge wouldn't let us put him on the stand. Our expert witness was never allowed to look at the evidence, so he couldn't give the same testimony about it. And, you know, the government also used that against him, stating, well, you can't talk about this stuff because you haven't seen it. Well, he hadn't seen it because the government and the court wouldn't let him look at it. It got to be an intolerable situation. And when he started to try and help out in the courtroom, my attorneys actively went over to the government's attorney and talked with them, and then they talked with the judge and had my expert witness removed from the courtroom, claiming that,
removed.
You know.
I mean, how was he removed?
Basically, he was told that he would be disruptive to what the government was doing in the courtroom when they were going to put Mr. Kingery on the stand. And I can understand why they thought he would be disruptive, because being an expert in the area of, you know, design and manufacturing firearms, he could listen to what the ATF's expert was saying and very easily do what he normally did in past trials and pass notes to me and my attorneys, telling us which questions to ask and, you know, what areas to attack him on, what he was doing wrong in his testing procedures, what might, you know, have been against standard procedures or the law. They didn't want that to happen, and apparently my attorneys were on board with that, and they went to the judge, and then the judge had him escorted out of the room.
Escorted, as in Bayless walked him out of the room and removed him?
All the way down. He wasn't even allowed to sit outside the courtroom. They brought him all the way down to the Federal Defender's Office, which was a couple floors down on the first level of the federal courthouse.
Wow. Okay. Now, during all of this, of course, I mean, you were a husband and father. And
at least back then.
Right. And you were the primary breadwinner for the family. And you had... you know, after your prosecution, which, I mean, the listeners, there's no way this man could not be prosecuted when the prosecution was the only one allowed to put on a case, when the defense was not allowed to even put on any sort of case whatsoever or defense whatsoever. So the jurors were only able to hear, this is what he's guilty of, this is what he did, this is, you know, how he acted. Now, we've already established the fact he was not convicted. He wasn't even charged with possessing an illegal machine gun. He was, and I'm sure, just as we know, and through the fully informed jury association, you know, where they, with their belief is that a jury is the first line of defense, or not first line of defense, I'm sorry, first line of checks and balances against government tyranny, yet the judges lie to them and tell them you can only examine the facts in this case. You can't examine the law, and you can't think outside. I mean, basically, they tell them, you have to think what we want you to think. So in this case, prosecution puts on their full case. Defense, not able to put on any exculpatory testimony whatsoever. Exculpatory being evidence that proves he's not guilty of this crime. Then the jury hears this one-sided case, and they're mandated to make a decision based on that information. Well, of course, they're going to convict. You know, all they heard was this guy's guilty, guilty, guilty. So do what we've told you to do. So he goes to jail, or I'm sorry, he goes to prison, not jail. He goes to prison for 21 months, being a primary breadwinner of the home, supporting a family. You had, I guess, for lack of a better term, kind of an angel on your shoulder who was supporting you or supporting your position and attempting to garner funds for your family so that they could survive while you're locked up in a gulag. And that was Mr. Pratt of Gun Owners of America. Is that right?
No, that is correct. He was absolutely a godsend throughout this entire thing and supportive above what, you know, I could believe was even possible from people in today's society. He definitely, you know, stood out in that respect, head and shoulders above anyone and everybody else, along with his organization. Whereas other organizations like the NRA, when we approached them and asked them if they could do anything, they refused. Mr. Pratt and Gun Owners of America stepped up to the plate, and they didn't just try to work with me and get the facts of the case straight to put information out there. They actively set up a trust fund to make sure that my family could eat while I was away, which was so much more than I would have expected from any individual organization out there. And I still think it's pretty, you know, unsurpassed today. I don't think there's any other organization out there for people in my situations that has ever done anything like that.
Now, the reason I bring this up and is twofold. One, you are very, very, you are the victim of this federal judicial misconduct, and so you're very close to it. And I have I was not aware of your situation until relatively recently. So I will bet that Mr. Pratt, being involved from early on, will have some information to fill in some of the holes that we've missed. You know, you being too close and me being new to it, I'm sure that he has some information concerning this case that would be very beneficial to our listeners. And I believe
probably a more level head too, because I, like you said, I'm too close to it, so I'm going to miss certain details. You get upset about some of what happened, and you know, stuff falls through the cracks. Mr. Pratt is definitely going to be a little more level-headed on this.
And you've brought him along with you, and he has been listening, from what my understanding. And so I'd like to ask Mr. Pratt some questions if he's available. Mr. Pratt, are you
there?
Can you hear
me? Here. I am here. Can
you
hear me?
Well, I can't thank you so much for what you've done for this citizen who has been, in my opinion, treated so. I mean, the destruction of his life and his family cannot be repaired, and I just can't believe. You know, I mean, first of all, thank you so much for you know, the efforts that you made to help support his family, and I know that was really important to him. It probably lent to his mental well-being while he was incarcerated for something he should never have even been questioned about. So I did my thanks.
I appreciate being described as level-headed, but frankly, David, I almost lost it over the last many minutes as you have rehearsed in my mind the outrage after outrage that was committed by a bunch of lying, criminal, syndicated thugs that work for the federal government and for the judiciary. This was just, you know, when you're close up and personal with a situation like this, and we took over at the appellate stage. We have a law firm that does their own retainer with us, and they've become very, very Second Amendment savvy, and they're good appellate lawyers, and they were just stunned at the misconduct after misconduct that was committed by the attorneys on both sides, by the judge. It is as if somebody had put out the word, that loudmouth Olofsson running around exercising his blankety-blank gun rights, we're going to take care of that guy. And it has all the earmarks of a premeditated vendetta, because the gun, at best, malfunctioned. It was never designed to be a machine gun. So under the law, there's no crime that can be attached to that gun as some sort of illegal machine gun, either owned or transferred or whatever the case might be. It was a malfunctioning gun, and we're not even sure of the reason. Did the 1,000 rounds that one of the previous borrowers had wear it down? Did somebody fiddle with it? Witness the bag of parts that David was describing in his dad's dining area. There's so many things that are so bad about this case, and then the ultimate offense was when we were turned down for a hearing at the Supreme Court, or in their parlance, they refused to give cert, writ of certiorari. One of the things that we had pointed out in our brief was that one of the case laws that had been used by the government to come down on David was not a Supreme Court decision, and it was in flat-out contradiction with an actual Supreme Court decision. And it makes me wonder if the clerks at the court actually read all the what must be a huge mountain of paper that flows in on them every day and week, or whether they just thought, you know, we can read the prosecution's account. This guy's as guilty as sin. Now, there's no point reading all this paperwork. Let's go for a round of golf.
Roger that. And now, Mr. Pat, can you tell me, you said that you became involved in not at the judiciary level, but at the appellate level. Is that correct?
That's right. We were just aghast when we learned from David some of the things of the conduct of the trial. And we've never gotten involved in an individual's case. Our MO is to submit friends of the court briefs so that things that we're seeing that might not be seen by the other attorneys, it'll be in our brief so that everything that can possibly be put before the next, you know, before the appellate court is put before them. And this case sure had a lot of stuff to put before them, but you would think that the Supreme Court would think, oh, they ruled in violation of one of our own decisions based on a lower court's decision to the contrary. I mean, it just never stopped being bad and getting worse.
Okay. And now, I heard you mention that earlier you had a legal team take a look at some of the documentation and procedures that were going on. Did you get any direct feedback from them about their opinion? And because in law, you know, just like doctors and lawyers and gun owners and even private investigation, we never perfect it. We always practice it. So in their practice of law, did you get feedback from your legal department about what was going on with Mr. Olson?
Oh, they were horrified, and I think David can confirm that from his end, because they dealt with him fairly extensively. And while the damage had been done at the trial court level, and so that limited the things that could be brought forth at the appellate level, like all of the defense that David was denied presenting, they still did a pretty good job in handling his defense. It's just, well, like I was pointing out a second ago, when the Supreme Court won't even pay a never mind to somebody flipping them off about their own decision, then you just wonder, did they even look at the stuff we presented them? It was very disappointing, to say the least.
I'll do that. And unfortunately, I've not had the ability to interview you prior to this, and I know you came on with short notice, and I thank you very much for your time in that.
I'm glad you're doing this with David. Thank you.
And, well, I'm very interested in this, and will continue my research long after this show. But is there anything that stands out?
Let me
tell
you, if you go to gunowners.org, which is the main site for Gun Owners of America, you'll find in one of the drop-down boxes a link to our Gun Owners Foundation. And there we have our appellate work posted for his case. So you can include that in your research. It's not exhaustive, but it has a lot of the Olson case material, and certainly the material that we generated.
Now, for the listeners, can you give them both the website and how to locate this documentation again?
Yeah, you go to gunowners.org, and then up on top, let me go in front of my computer, there's a bar of drop-down boxes, and let me pull up our page.
Not a problem. Well, I'll do that. So it's gunowners.org,
right.
And on the, you say on the top right-hand part of the page?
Yeah, if you go to, go to the home box right over on the left, there'll be a link to the Gun Owners Foundation. And when you hit that, I recall, litigation. There's a bar up on the top, and one of the selections is litigation. And the first one on the top of the stack is U.S. v. Olson. And you click on that, and it takes you right into all of our material.
And real briefly, can you tell the listeners what the Gun Owners Foundation primarily does?
Mostly appellate work dealing with mostly directly related to the Second Amendment, but there are times when we've been active working on the Fourth Amendment, because if you can have your home or your office invaded without a warrant, without due process, then your guns are going to be in jeopardy. I can think specifically of when Billy Clinton had his federal agents going door-to-door through projects, taxpayer-funded housing, where that they claimed that meant that they didn't need any stinking due process. And they would ask, hey, Johnny, I know your parents aren't home, but do they have any guns in the house? And they'd grab them. The Fourth Amendment's kind of a key provision that's tied around the axle of the Second Amendment. And the First Amendment, likewise, we went to the Supreme Court against McCain's horrible political speech gag law in an effort to get it overturned, and we were a friend of the court on Citizens United, which finally did get a substantial part of it overturned. It was making it extremely difficult for us to communicate with the public about the gun record, anti or pro, of a candidate. And so obviously the dysfunctioning of the, if there's such a word, of the First Amendment was pretty critical to our ability to defend the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, returning to Mr. Olson, we've covered, a minor amount of information concerning his background, who he was, what he believed in, which is it's very clear that he his belief in his rights was well founded. He just had the courage to actually exercise those. We've covered his loaning the weapon out, his desire to properly assist people in not only the safe but practical application of firearms. Then he would, after he was okay with people, their handling of the weapon, he didn't mind loaning his personal weapons out to people so that they could practice with them at a
No good deed goes unpunished, as we say, eh?
Roger that. You got that right. And then through his investigation, through his prosecution and incarceration, is there anything that stands out in your mind that we have not touched on, something that may have stuck with you, over time? It's like, oh, my God, I can't believe what a travesty this is. Or, on the flip side, something that really was a blessing. Anything that stands out in your mind at all that we have not covered?
Well, having seen his family before the federal wrecking ball went through it, I can tell you that David might want to disagree with this, and I certainly would stand aside, but even worse, I think, than the months of his life they stole and the branding him of a felon was the major contribution they made to the destruction of his family. The woman is the weaker vessel, as the Bible tells us, and to put a family under this stress and to have the mother have to bear up and be this all of a sudden the sole breadwinner and have the shame of her husband in jail. Now, she knows that it was not a good thing, an honest thing that the government did, but tell that to the friends. All they know is what they read in the paper. And while we all say we don't trust the media, we also all tend to have a reaction that, I read it in the paper, and gee, if David Olson, some kind of machine gun runner, well then, darn, I didn't know I was living next door to something like that. And unhappily, that's the way, I think I've been guilty of that myself, so I can appreciate how easily it happens. And that, I think, was the bigger tragedy, that community shame, that pressure on her as the sole breadwinner, she broke. And, it's not like David is as innocent as the driven snow himself. I mean, all of us fall short. But, frankly, because she was left alone to raise a young family with a felonious husband that was just, I think it was more than she could bear. Pretty sure it was.
Okay. Well,
and I tell you what, if I ever had the opportunity to work with a Congress that was committed to justice, I would seek out the names of the judges and the agents and the prosecutor that working for the federal government that did these outrageous things, because they knew what they were doing, and I would defund their salary by name and their pension benefits by name.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I can't say I disagree with you on that. They've proven not only their lack of integrity, but their propensity for deceit and treachery.
Absolutely. They should not be allowed in the courthouse again the rest of their lives, and certainly we shouldn't be paying for it.
I agree with you there as well. Absolutely. Now, to go back to you, Mr. Olofsson, we've not touched on this yet, but can you give us, now, I think we pretty clearly established that you were wrongfully convicted, not only based on the evidence, but based on the conduct of the courts and the procedural, just the simple procedural violations they made, which were horrendous and ridiculous, doesn't change the fact. Now you're stigmatized as a convicted felon. And you've lost your family over this. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. And, I don't want to touch on painful subjects for you because I understand how that could be rather emotional. But are you even Now, you were only gone, you were gone for the better part of 2 years of your life. But that's 2 years in the life of a human. Are you allowed to see your children now?
Right now, no.
Yes, okay. And can you tell us what the courts have told you about why you can't see your children?
A couple of things. I've been told I can't see them because, A, I've been removed from them for so long, it would be traumatic if they were suddenly reintroduced to me and my family. I've also been told that teaching or attempting to teach children anything about religion is not a good thing. They're essentially supposed to be atheists until they reach the age of majority and can choose religion on their own. And, of course, the fact that I owned guns in the past and have actively disagreed with the government goes to show that I have a propensity to not follow authority and not want to follow the law.
So how dare you teach
children? All of which naturally place children in danger.
Okay. The producer just handed me a note and said that there was someone named, before I bring this individual on, I want to get your clearance on this, an individual identified only as Kelly who was supposed to testify at your trial?
Yes. The person I was telling you about that was actually with me in the courtroom with Len Savage that I brought there, and I considered a key witness at least, would have been Kelly. If he called in, great. But he can also, testify as to some of what went on in the courtroom, when he had the gun, what the gun did while he had it, all of which is in direct contradiction to the fiction that, Mr. Kernicke told. Of course, I find it kind of hard to fault Mr. Kernicke because he was only 18, and, when you got a bunch of federal agents threatening you, your average kid isn't going to do it too much more other than say, okay, what do you want me to say so that I don't get in any trouble or you don't do nothing to me?
Absolutely. Exactly. And that's terrible. You're absolutely right. So many people are terrified of doing the right thing that they will do the wrong thing in order to save themselves. But with your permission, I'd like to bring Kelly on and at least hear what he has to say and maybe have a couple of questions for him. Is that okay?
No, knock yourself out.
Okay. Kelly, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hi, Kelly. How are you? This is welcome to Police in America. Unfortunately, rest easy at night. You're protected and safe. Law enforcement's on the job.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about your experience in this situation.
Well, I've known Dave for 10 years now, and the gun in question I've fired many times over the course of the years. Probably half the guys in town have fired that. I'm being facetious, but a lot of folks have fired that gun over the course of many years, and I actually had it at my house for quite a few months. I was using it and shooting it,
mm-hmm.
And there was nothing illegal about that gun. In court, they were talking about an unmarked third position. There was no such thing. It was fire and safe. There was no
mm-hmm.
unmarked third position. It was a semi-automatic gun. And David never professed to even wanting a machine gun. He liked to shoot accurately. He disparaged turning money into noise, so to speak.
Understood.
I tend to agree with that position, by the way. It's a very expensive way to hit nothing or very little.
Roger that. I agree. And I've been a shooter for 36 years. And, I have no desire to, as long as I'm funding my own ammo, I have no desire to burn through 100 pounds. And
the best training I had on a machine gun was at a training institute where they taught us with the gun, the selector switch on full auto, they taught us how to fire one shot at a time, so we developed really good trigger control.
Mm-hmm. Roger that. So, not only well, there are several other. I agree with you on that. But Kelly, I want to ask you, in your experience in the courtroom during this trial, did you see anything that made you go, "Oh my God"?
Well, I wasn't privy to a lot of the discussions. I was in the audience for quite a bit of it. I was supposed to be a witness, but they wouldn't let me take the stand.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecutor, two things really stuck out to me. The prosecutor was visibly shaking. Now, I don't know what kind of ungodly pressure he was under to get a conviction, but he was scared out of his wits. That's my opinion. He was shaken
mm-hmm.
that whole trial. And at the end, he summed up. Because, in my opinion, the feds messed with that gun. They messed with that gun. That's my opinion. Can't prove it, but that's my opinion. But he told the jury, he said, it all comes down to the statute. Read the statute. Somebody pulled the trigger, more than one bullet came out. He said, it doesn't matter how that gun got to that point.
Oh, that's not true.
And he said, yeah, and I said, red lights are going on in my head. They saw your barrel off to 6 inches long and then tell a jury that you're in possession of an illegal gun. Doesn't matter who sawed it off, just the fact that the barrel is too short. So red lights were going on in my head at that point. I said,
you know,
if this becomes a precedent, we're all guilty.
Well, because they can make you guilty. Well, Kelly, this might be a bit of a stretch, but, you know, if I have the same vehicle for 10 years, and one day I decide I don't like my neighbor, and I run him down in the street, then I should, you know, and kill him, then I should be prosecuted for murder. But if I have the same vehicle for 10 years and the brakes work every time, until that one day when he steps out in the street and I attempt to hit the brakes and they don't work and I run him down and kill him, should I still be prosecuted for murder? I mean, by the same philosophy that they introduced in this court, that would be yes, absolutely. You should be sent to jail for murder because your brakes failed.
I guess it depends on whether they like you or not.
And in this case, the gun either malfunctioned or I hadn't quite realized how much the feds had possibly been messing with the gun. Maybe it didn't malfunction. Maybe it had been adjusted for their tests that they, you know, took them, as David was pointing out, took them so long to finish testing the gun. They must have had to consult real experts, which is something that they would have trouble finding at the ATF itself.
And I won't get into that. That's why I wish Len Savage could have made it here, because he has intimate knowledge about which experts out in the industry were actually consulted by the ATF for that.
Hmm. Well, I can't believe they would consult experts, since they'd already established that only government-trained personnel are experts. No one else is. But I guess they... Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's their position, okay, and they're sticking to it.
Roger that. No kidding. So, Kelly, anything else that you can think of that, you know, because, again, I'm relatively new to this case, and you know, my apologies to you, Mr. Olson. I've been involved in the Patriot Movement in a long time, but I was not aware of your case, and it was brought to me by a mutual friend. And I've been doing my research on it. And it horrified me, the whole story. So, Kelly, anything that you can think of that Mr. Olson or Mr. Pratt did not cover that may stand out in your mind, you know, it could be something minor, but, it might still be important to the case itself, so that the people that are listening understand. So many people, well, I think you brought it up earlier, Mr. Pratt, that you read something in black and white, and in today's society, it doesn't take evidence. It only takes an accusation to make you guilty.
That's right.
And that's just, not only is that not according to the U.S. Constitution, but that's not according to logic, people. I can accuse you of anything. That doesn't mean you did it.
Right. They have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And what that means to me, if and when I'm on a jury, I'm going to assume that the government got it wrong in the most charitable construction, and quite possibly is lying, and they're going to have a lot of catch-up to do in order to convince me, beyond a reasonable doubt, that defendant really as guilty. I've seen too many cases, not as intimately as David Olofsson's, but I've seen too many cases, been familiar with too many, to ever go in there with that presumption of innocent. It just is so essential. And just because a pretty prosecutor lady or a handsome prosecutor man makes these allegations, and they'll almost always be well spoken, and they'll just be so convincing. And of course, you can be convincing to almost anybody if you can control the evidence stream, which is what they did in David's case.
Roger that. They say no one's more charming than the devil. So a question I like to ask of all my guests, I'd like to start with you, Mr. Olofsson. A police officer, whether he be a uniformed officer or a detective or a federal agent, if he is walking, whether you're standing on private or public property, doesn't matter. If a police officer has locked his eyes on you and is walking directly toward you, do you feel safer because of his presence and feel, okay, I won't be victimized by crime because there's a cop here, or do you feel intimidated because he's approaching you?
Intimidated might be putting it lightly, especially, you know, there's a particular use of force continuum that they follow, and they, mm-hmm. they tend to escalate very, very quickly, you know, from mere presence to placing their hands on you to using non-lethal weapons to going to lethal weapons, and they can do that in a heartbeat based on whatever their perception is. There's been plenty of cases.
If they're coming on your land, David, there's one thing I've been learning recently from some work that would be another show altogether, but it's to ask them, where is your warrant from a Title III court? If they haven't gone through the basics of due process and they're on your land and they don't have a warrant, they can be in big trouble, and you could sue them for everything they've got under a provision of Title 42 in the U.S. Code.
I want to put a caveat out here just because we have to, based on the existence of lawyers. Please understand, listeners, none of us are attorneys. We cannot issue legal advice. However, we can issue citizens' warnings to each other.
And leads to follow up on with a competent attorney.
Roger that. Absolutely. Now, Mr. Olofsson, obviously, I mean, you have lost your family over this. You have been ostracized by the employing community for the most part. How have you been able to support yourself and take care? After all of this shakes out, what have you had to do to be able to live, to be able to eat?
Well, immediately after returning, naturally, you have to go on a job hunt. Nobody in my past contracting ability as an IT professional, even the places that really loved me, told me outright, we'd love to have you back, except, you know, taking me back, given that the case was higher profile, in their view, they believed it might have been seen by the government as taking a side on my case. And they didn't want any of the related headaches that may go with that. So I went back to looking for normal work in any way, make, shape, or form. And I think we can sum that up with one interview I had, just trying to get a basic janitorial job, where the human resources lady told me flat out, because in Wisconsin, you know, it's illegal to tell someone you're not going to hire them because of a criminal conviction. She just told mm-hmm. me, let me put it to you this way, and this is a quote, it doesn't matter who walks through that door. They're more qualified for this job than you. And that was just a sweep and mop. Something
wow.
which, thanks to both the military and prison, I was very good at. So, you know, working a normal job at that point, you know, that really drove it home to me that it wasn't going to happen. You know, it's hard enough. If you have that felony on your record, but when you have the felony and you end up on CNN, then you're radioactive. people want absolutely nothing to do with you. So the only thing left for me was to try and go back to what I did to some extent, start up a business, and bury my name behind a corporate shield so that basically they didn't have an idea up front who they were working with. All they knew was they were working with a company that did this, and they got the products and services that they were looking for. You know, and by the time they figure anything out about me, usually they didn't care anymore because they were already entrenched. And that's managed to at least go okay, where, you know, there's it's primarily manufacturing and engineering for, you know, mechanical parts. And then there's a small subsidiary where I have some folks that make some handmade olive oil soaps and do up some gift baskets that we sell, which is also manufacturing, although it's in a very different area. And we've managed over the past 6 months to do pretty good in that and at least keep our head above water. But like any small business, you got to work a lot harder, you know, if you have a small business than you ever would if you had a normal job. And just because you do good today does not mean that you're going to do good tomorrow. So, yeah,
and there's an ad for those gift boxes and the soaps on the front page of at gunowners.org. So, you know, people might want to do the same thing. That's another way that they can, you know, help David out. And I hope people will think of doing that.
Roger that, listeners. You know, I mean, imagine this happening to you or someone in your family. And, you know, I mean, this man, he obviously believed in his country. He served his country for the better part of two decades of his life. And now he can't even get a job sweeping and mopping. So you don't have to donate. You don't have to put money out so to help him out. Everybody uses soap, you know? So maybe if you want to, even if you don't want it for yourself, make a gift basket for someone else, which, you know, personalized handmade soap. You know, that's kind of a cool gift to give someone. David, do you have a website where people would be able to find your products?
No, if they wanted to, you know, if they happen to need parts or engineering services, they can catch our larger corporate website at ddpservices.net. Or the other one, if they're looking for the soaps, would be jewelsofnature.com, J-O-U-L-E-S, ofnature.com.
And the first one again was DDP, Delta Delta Papa Services?
Correct.
And was that .com or .net?
That's .net.
Okay. ddpservices.net. And the other one again, Jules, and give that spelling again, please.
J-O-U-L-E-S ofnature.com.
Very good.
If there's one thing I can say for our soaps, we have over 120 different scents that we have out there. So there's no one else on the marketplace that has what we have as far as the quantity of scents go. It's kind of overwhelming, especially if you ever have to spend any time around that many different scents at once. Kind of gets to you.
Right. Now, look, listeners, this is a good way to support a fellow patriot who has already been victimized by the tyranny so many of you fear. He has already lost everything, including his children. So I encourage you to write these websites down, visit them, and, you know, make an order that would help out someone who he hasn't claimed victim status ever once. I'm the one that called him that because I believe he's been victimized by scumbags, to be kind. This is a good way to help out a fellow citizen who's already paid the price for not only believing but also being outspoken in his beliefs and his rights. And also now, Mr. Pratt, I would like you to take just a couple of moments to tell us about Gun Owners of America, if you would, please. You know, everyone's familiar with the NRA, not everyone's familiar with GOA. So if you could, give us just a brief rundown of what your organization is about, what it does, what it represents.
Well, we're primarily a lobbying organization. Gun Owners Foundation is the entity that conducted the appellate defense for David. And people say, well, how do you differ from the NRA? I say, well, kind of in the way that Representative Alan West differs from Speaker John Boehner. Alan West led men into combat. John Boehner bends over backwards whenever the Democrats want anything.
Okay, understood. You have a lobbying group?
Yes, that's Gun Owners of America is primarily lobbying. Gun Owners Foundation does litigation, mostly appellate work. That's how we got involved with David, not through GOA directly, but through Gun Owners Foundation. And we also have a political committee which gives contributions to people like Alan West that we have seen evidence that they are willing to stand up to the leadership and not fold like a chair whenever the pressure is being applied. And it's a constant struggle to try to find people like that who really are what we're looking for. So if a person's been a state legislator, we'll try to check out what they've been like in that arena. And did they stand up to the leadership then? If they did, if they have a reputation of not playing well with other children, then they're probably going to fit very well in the profile of what we're looking for.
Okay, excellent. Now, how do people become members of Gun Owners of America?
They can go to gunowners.org. Right on the front page, there's a couple of red buttons. One is to sign up for our legislative alerts, which are typically on a weekly basis. And those will have embedded in them an email that can be sent to the appropriate member of Congress. Please support or oppose this piece of legislation. And the other button they can hit, and that will take them to the page where they can actually become a member, which anything will get you in the door. We ask a minimum of 20 if that can be afforded.
Okay, very good. Gunowners.org.
Yes, sir, that's it.
All right, thank you very much. And now I want to keep you gentlemen for a couple of minutes. If you don't mind, I know we're coming to the last 20 minutes of the show. I want to go over some things that these are issues in general that we face with police. Now, understand, listeners, that police don't end at the police department. They don't end at the sheriff's department or the FBI branch. That's only a tool of the judicial area of our system. When you are accused of a crime, the prosecutor is the one that decides whether that will be pursued or not, and only after he's presented with a certain amount of evidence from the police department. He or she, I should say, and prosecutor utilizes all law enforcement to find evidence against you. Now, if it runs the way it's supposed to, when the prosecutor finds exculpatory evidence or evidence that clears you of that crime, he or she is supposed to present that to the defense immediately. He or she cannot hide that information. They do it on a routine
basis. Or let alone tamper with the evidence, which is quite possibly what happened in David's case.
Well, you know, it certainly sounds like that may have been what happened. I appreciate his, David, I appreciate your objectivity in this, in that you didn't say they absolutely did, even though I know that in your heart you believe they tampered with that firearm.
You don't even want to know what's in my heart when I'm thinking about them.
All right. So I just want to go over a couple of things that, all right, now, I want to talk about the distinctions between the privileges, and the cops will often misuse the word right, you know, as in, I have the right to ask you for ID. No, it's not a right. That's a privilege. It's a privilege. It's a privilege based on your position as a law enforcement officer. It's not a right. It doesn't exist above the law.
And I presume he needs a probable cause to be asking, because if he's just doing it to harass, that's another matter.
Well, you know, again, this is can be state by state based on the 10th Amendment. However, in most states, law enforcement are not even supposed to ask you for provable identification unless you're driving a vehicle, because that's a contract between you and the state concerning your driving privileges.
Right.
But if you're walking here in Florida, that's where I am, here in Florida, if you're walking in an area that's considered usual and customary, which would be, you know, sidewalk, parking lot, anywhere, as long as you're not hunkered down in the dark behind a convenience store at midnight and law enforcement approaches you and says, give me some ID, well, you're certainly not required. This is not Nazi Germany. You're not required to produce your papers. You have to tell them honestly who you are and, you know, the city you live in. But you can have ID in your pocket and within your rights decline to provide that to them. It's not their...
Asking about, you know, what is the constitutional basis for his request? Because I want to know what the probable cause is. If there's not
right.
a reasonable doubt that I'm on the up and up, then he could, by rights, get himself in trouble.
Well, I just want to discuss these as the privileges that are afforded police because of their position as a law enforcement officer. So you're absolutely right in that, Mr. Pratt, but I don't want to get caught up in the semantics of that. I want people to understand that, you know, when a cop tells you, hey, I have the right to know who you are, no, you don't. No, you don't. No, you have the privilege, but not the right. And I don't want people to I've gone over this in the past, and I just want to touch on it briefly here. There are laws, and laws only exist if they can be tied directly to the U.S. Constitution. There are legalities, which are unconstitutional laws that we all must follow every day, otherwise face arrest, unlawful convictions. But they are not laws because they cannot be tied to the Constitution and often are in direct contradiction to the U.S. Constitution. These are considered legalities. Then there are rights. Rights ascend above both laws and legalities. Now, rights exist simply because you do, or because there are two types of rights. There are inalienable or God-given rights, and there are constitutionally protected rights. And the difference being, let's just take the First Amendment, for example. The right to, or the first right protected in the First Amendment is your right to have whatever religion you want, and it's not affected, I mean, can't be affected by the state. In this instance, the state includes the federal government. All right, so a God-given right would be your right to choose the God you want. Regardless.
Well, the right to life.
Law of man. Now, a constitutionally protected right would be the right of the freedom of the press, because the press is a man-made entity. Therefore, it's not something that's given to you by God, but it's protected by the U.S. Constitution. So I want people to understand the difference between God-given rights or inalienable rights and constitutionally protected rights. Now, in your story, Mr. Ogleson, you've discussed a litany of violations of both rights and multiple laws, and even legalities, because you've referenced, you know, different courts or the same court making rulings concerning issues that were similar to yours, and then reversing themselves on those or going in contrast to those. So there's nothing left that they can violate. They've violated your legalities, your laws, your constitutionally protected rights, and your God-given rights. It's ridiculous. I mean, that's why I referred to you as a victim, because you have absolutely been victimized. Now, in law enforcement, I would like to have your input on some of this. The privileges of police over the citizens of this country, things like the use of force or searches expansive firearms immunities, you know, these things. All right, like if I think you stole something from me, Mr. Pratt, Well, if I come over and start going through your pockets without your permission, and you bust me in the nose for it, I pretty much had that coming. If a law enforcement officer decides he wants to go through your pockets, regardless of your Fourth Amendment protections, and you bust him in the nose for it, guess what happens?
But I will tell him to get a warrant, and if he doesn't, I'm going to sue him under Title 42. And I'll explain it to him.
But you must.
And then he might go through my pockets, and then we're going to. Then I'm going to go see my lawyer.
Right, but it doesn't matter. You still have to subject yourself to something from a police officer that you would never have to subject yourself from any other person in this society. None whatsoever.
And he might suffer consequences that he's not aware under the scenario you just presented if he doesn't have probable cause.
That brings us to our second point. The police are unduly supported and deferred to by the courts, by existing legislation, public opinion. I mean, all of these things, if you and a cop disagree on any set of circumstances anywhere in life, the media, the courts, and the public, for whatever reason, tend to defer to the police officer as the more honest of the two.
Now, hopefully those listening to your program tonight are not going to have that problem. If they did going into the show, hopefully they won't anymore.
Roger that. That's my point. Thank you so much for making that. That's exactly what I was getting to. I want people to understand, listen, there's nothing that humans touch that they don't mess up. And law enforcement affords a certain amount of authority to those that either wear the badge or keep the badge in their wallet. And that tends to cause a certain amount of over time, it lends itself to immense corruption. You can see that in this case with Mr. Olofsson. The corruption, not only of the courts, but all the way down from the very first cop who said, yeah, there's something wrong with this firearm, and took that weapon without a warrant. He couldn't. I mean, when you're deprived of property, it has to be, according to the U.S. Constitution, a due process of law. Yet there was none from the very second they took that weapon.
Yeah, because he had not heard the gun be fired. He is not known to be a qualified firearms expert, and certainly I can safely assert not in the league of Len Savage. So for him to just take the gun based on that presumption of another person who was not subject to any adversarial proceeding, the cops crossed the line, and here I'm going to come again with Title 42.
Mr. Olofsson, during your questioning, and we touched on this briefly during our conversation earlier, and I wanted you to expand on that some. During your questioning, did they seem to be on a fact-finding mission, or were they intimidating and pressuring?
Oh, there was definitely an attempt at, you know, intimidation and pressure, threats with, this is what's going to happen if you don't tell us what we want to hear. I repeatedly, even though I was, locked in a room, behind multiple locked doors, I should say, I repeatedly asked to go, and they just utterly refused. Their excuse was my house was still being searched, so I couldn't leave at all. Now, what my house being searched had to do with them having to keep me down at the police station, I'm not sure to this day, but that's their excuse.
Okay. So can you give us, when you said they were definitely intimidating, can you give us some specific examples other than, this is what's going to happen to you? I mean, tell me, how the room was set up, how many people were questioning you, what was the pressure like, how many times did different officers ask you the exact same question over and over?
Well, basically, we had two officers in the room, one from Berlin PD and one, Special Agent Jody Kiku from the BATFE. Miss Kiku was the one that asked almost all the questions.
She's the expert.
Yeah, the officer detective from Berlin PD just sat back and listened. But she would repeatedly ask her questions. She would throw a few of what she apparently considered facts out there, tell me that, you know, according to what she had, I was obviously in a lot of trouble and I needed to just come clean and tell them, you know, all the illegal things I was involved with. And that went on multiple times. Needless to say, since I wasn't involved in anything illegal, there was very little to tell.
Mm-hmm. All right. And did they question members of your family at all?
They did to some extent. I know they questioned both my wife and my children. Our children were questioned outside of our presence and without our knowledge.
How old were they at the time?
And without an attorney.
Well, Alex at that time would have been, I think, 6 years old.
Wow. Wow.
And so no attorney, no guardian ad litem for that child. I think that's one of the that's an additional offense that was committed against David Olson.
Well, children, you know, they're often taught, police are our protectors and blah blah blah, whatever. But when they're questioning a child about their own father, what they're actually doing is vilifying and demonizing that child's father, just simply because the kid's going to be intimidated. They don't, you know, they're not comfortable in their surroundings. They don't know this stranger, but they know the stranger has authority, and now they're asking about their daddy. And even if the kid, you know, loves their daddy, it's going to leave a lasting impression on them that, well, something must be wrong with my daddy or they wouldn't be asking these questions.
Right. Yeah, so if I remember correct, in that case, they went to Alex because, as part of their warrant, they were looking for all these fully automatic weapons that I was supposedly manufacturing in my house. Their, initial search of the residence turned up a grand total of zero machine guns and zero machine gun parts, zero tools necessary to manufacture machine guns. What they had was a bunch of old double-barrel shotguns, which, according to my case, supposedly are machine guns, too. After, Mr. Savage got questioned on that, he asked him, it's like, well, if I got my granddaddy's double-barrel shotgun and I pull the trigger once and it fires both barrels, is that a machine gun? And the government's answer was yes. But, there's a couple of bolt-action rifles, a couple of double-barrel shotguns, and some pump shotguns that were taken apart.
And by the way, David,
semi-auto 22.
Let's just underscore that the government's answer is wrong. A malfunction does not mean that the gun was designed for that one trigger pull to fire both barrels. That means something's wrong with the gun. And they've changed the definition of the law that they have to work with. And that was one of the bigger outrages, the bigger pieces of misconduct that was committed against you in that trial.
Gentlemen, and we're down to the last 2 minutes of the show, and I wanted to give you this time either to go over websites you've already mentioned, or if you're involved in some organization that you believe passionately enough that the listeners should know about, please use this time to tell them about what you really, really believe in.
Well, David, get your website out because we got to get some business directed your way.
Roger.
Well, if anyone needs help with manufacturing components or some engineering help, then yes, they can come to ddpservices.net. If they're looking for gifts or some superior handmade soaps at a exceedingly reasonable cost, jewelsofnature.com. As far as organizations, I know with my case, obviously Gun Owners of America is head and shoulders above any other large national organization. And then we had a lot of support from so many smaller organizations. I couldn't even begin to count them, although I know like Corey Graff and Wisconsin Gun Owners did a lot locally right in Wisconsin. The list of people to thank in helping me on the case and get things rolling appropriately is too long to go into, but those are the notable ones.
All right, thank you, gentlemen, so much for being on. We're down to like the last 30 seconds. Mr. Pratt, Kelly, I don't know if you're still there, and Mr. Ogleson, yep. Thank you for your stories on this. I really appreciate you enlightening the listeners into what kind of misconduct went on, and this is not an isolated case, people. Pay attention.
No, it is not.
And, no, it's not. And again, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time, and we really appreciate it. And Mr. Ogleson, I'll stay in touch with you.
Okay, well, any time, and I'm happy to help in any way I can.
All right. Take care and good night, gentlemen.
Good night.
Good night.